choose their representatives free from an unprecedented avalanche of spending on TV and radio.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan calls for a pledge to curb outside influence in the race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state prepares for the closing of the National Archives in Anchorage.
It's so important for Alaskans to speak up, speak out about what records they need to have access to.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
U.S. Senate candidate Dan Sullivan is calling on incumbent Mark Begich to sign a pledge to discourage outside groups from running political ads in the race. The pledge would impose a financial penalty on a campaign that benefits from outside spending. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the Begich campaign isn't buying it.
Political ads already dominate the airwaves, many of them from political action committees that can collect so-called dark money, unlimited contributions with no public disclosure. So far, some $20 million of Alaska airtime has been reserved. That's more than $60 per likely voter. Sullivan's challenge says if an outside group runs an ad that benefits him or Begich after July 4, that candidate's campaign would have to make a donation equal to half the amount of the ad buy to charity. Sullivan announced the pledge in a call-in press conference.
We should be able to agree that Alaskans should choose their representatives free from an unprecedented avalanche of spending on TV and radio from third-party special interest groups.
He says a similar pledge worked in the 2012 U.S. Senate race in Massachusetts. There, Republican Scott Brown proposed the pledge. Democrat Elizabeth Warren agreed to it and ultimately won. Akene Freechild of the left-leaning consumer advocacy group Public Citizen is delighted to see the pledge show up again in Alaska.
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful news. We've really been looking to encourage candidates to propose and take the pledge, and I think this is a great start.
Candidates and dark money groups aren't allowed to collaborate, so in theory, groups could ignore the pledge and bankrupt the campaigns that sign it. But Freechild says in Massachusetts, groups generally stayed off the air and let the campaigns speak for themselves.
That is one of the most disturbing features of this election cycle, is this effort to completely drown out any effort by the candidates or other members of the public to be heard on the issues that matter to them.
Sullivan included only radio and TV ads in the pledge. That would leave outside groups free to buy web ads, send direct mail, and continue robocalls. Begich campaign spokesman Max Crows says Sullivan is being disingenuous because, in announcing the challenge, Sullivan also endorsed Citizens United. That's the Supreme Court case that opened the door to dark money spending in elections as a matter of corporate First Amendment rights. Crows says Sullivan is just trying to score political points.
We're waiting for Sullivan to propose a serious solution to the effects of his spending. And today he said one thing and then he did another.
Sullivan, though, says his proposal has nothing to do with Citizens United.
It's a pledge on how we're going to conduct this race with the proven strategy that's worked before. But I strongly support Citizens United and strong protections for everyone's First Amendment rights.
The pledge document Sullivan posted online leaves room only for Mark Begich to sign, ignoring Joe Miller and Mead Treadwell, the Republican Sullivan will have to beat in the August primary. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Since April, gubernatorial challengers Byron Mallott and Bill Walker have gone after incumbent Sean Parnell for skipping debates. They hit that point again last night at a candidate forum hosted by the National Congress of American Indians. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Independent candidate Bill Walker didn't even finish his opening statement before taking a swipe at the governor.
You notice who is not on the panel with us. Governor Parnell has chosen not to show. And I think that's a shame that he chooses not to participate in these processes. Remember that on Election Day.
Democrat Byron Mallott went after Parnell, too.
Bill and I have spent many months on the campaign trail thus far. And it's almost like we're the only two candidates.
Their displeasure with Parnell's absence was one of a few areas where the competing candidates agreed on Monday. For example, they also told attendees at the National Congress of American Indians that the state needs to make a disaster declaration in response to the high energy prices in rural areas. Because of the similarities in their platforms, the candidates were asked if they feared splitting the vote in a way that could benefit Parnell. Walker again pivoted back to Parnell's debate attendance.
The other guy that doesn't seem to show up, doesn't seem to pay attention or want to engage with the public, he'll come in third, so we'll be fine.
Since Walker and Mallott announced their candidacies last year, Parnell has joined them in two candidate forums and skipped four. His campaign manager, Jerry Gallagher, says Parnell will be participating in a large number of debates after the primary. But until then,
we don't want to obviously take anything for granted, and we want to respect the process, and we'll do that, and then we'll move on to the general.
As the incumbent governor, Parnell is expected to easily win the Republican nomination. Two of his three challengers have run for governor before and received less than 1% of the vote or were disqualified. Russ Millett is the best-known candidate running against Parnell in the primary. Millett was elected chair of the Alaska Republican Party by a group of libertarian-minded activists in 2012, but was quickly ousted by the party's establishment wing. Gallagher says there are currently no specific plans to debate those primary candidates, but adds that Parnell will consider campaign events on a case-by-case basis. The next debate Parnell plans to attend is in August, with at least five more events scheduled after the primary. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Gakona High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HARP, may have been saved in the nick of time. According to Alan LeMaster, who runs a lodge at Gakona Junction, five room reservations made by U.S. Air Force officials for this week have been canceled, he says, because demolition of the research facility has been put on hold. LeMaster told APRN that leaders of the demolition project told him that a cease and desist order has been issued for the scheduled demolition. APRN has not had official confirmation of the order to halt the HARP demolition, but Carl Gruznick, a public information officer with the Air Force Research Lab in New Mexico, says it's not unusual for large projects to be put on hold temporarily because of delays in negotiations with contractors. Gruznick says the Air Force has completed its research at HARP, which has been slated for closure as of today. And Charles Gulick with the U.S. Air Force Press Office emailed today that at this time he has no word on the order to cease and desist, but that he will have more information in the future. Meanwhile, Matt Felling, a spokesperson with Senator Lisa Murkowski's office, says an announcement will be made on Monday. For the first time in Alaska and the United States, a company is flying drones over land for commercial purposes. BP is using unmanned aerial systems to inspect roads, gravel pads, and pipelines on the North Slope. It's the first time the Federal Aviation Administration has approved drones for this type of use. Kurt Smith is the technology director for BP. He says the 4.5-foot-long aircraft uses cameras and laser systems to map areas and collect data they can't get from conventional methods.
So we can't drive over there because it's tundra, whereas the Puma can fly over it without any damage or without harassing animals because it's silent and invisible. Unless you're just staring at it, you wouldn't notice it was there.
Smith says the planes can fly low enough and slow enough to capture high-quality data about the thickness of the roads and gravel pads to make sure they are protecting the tundra. Pilots from AeroVironment control the 9-foot-wide Puma AE aircraft. They launch them by hand and have to stay in visual range for safety reasons. Smith says the project is good for BP because they're getting better quality data than they would otherwise, but they're also breaking new ground for many companies.
I think the big thing is it's the trailblazer that the FAA and AeroVironment and BP have worked out. How do you get the permission? And being first is always difficult because you get the stumbling blocks and say, well, what am I going to do with that? And then you figure it out and you go on. But once that's figured out, then you should be able to leverage that for the next time, right?
A spokesperson from the FAA says filmmakers are already applying to use the unmanned craft in controlled low-risk situations like movie sets. The FAA is required by Congress to allow the use of drones in the Arctic for commercial purposes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Tlingit carver repairs a totem pole for the Anchorage Museum.
It's all about educating and sharing our culture with people from wherever they are.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
At a wide-ranging press conference during day three of the NCAI gathering in Anchorage today, BIA Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn said the concept of taking land into trust for Alaska tribes is a popular one.
Even though we don't have a rule in place that allows it, we have applications.
A recent D.C. District Court decision affirmed the Interior Department's authority to take Alaska tribal lands into trust if tribes request it, and the Secretary of Interior request. Washburn said although the decision is being appealed, the court was clear in the assertion. He said the issue is also supported by two other entities.
One from the Secretarial Commission on Trust Reform, which was set up at the Department of the Interior, and it was a blue ribbon panel of outside independent experts who said, we think this would be a good idea. We also heard from the Indian Law and Order Commission, which set a whole chapter on Alaska, because they were looking at issues for Indian law and order all over the country, but the issues in Alaska are very serious, and so they set aside Chapter 2.
Trust status for Native lands would allow more tribal authority and jurisdiction over certain criminal behavior on those trust lands. The Indian Law and Order Commission sees it as a way to better address the high rates of domestic violence and sexual assault in Alaska Native communities. Washburn said there have been applications from Interior and Southeast Alaska tribes. The National Archives in Anchorage is closing its doors to researchers in less than 2 weeks, despite impassioned pleas by historians and researchers. But they aren't the only ones who use the stacks of historical records. KSKA's Ann Hillman found out more.
Playwright Peter Porco sits in the white-walled research room of the National Archives in Anchorage. He's searching through stacks of old papers from ADAC in the 1940s.
I mean, here's another one. Look, handwritten. I'm going to take a picture of this because I think it's just so neat. Oh, wow. Good. A cigarette burn. We got a cigarette burn and a piece of paper. I mean, that's so silly. I can't help thinking how silly it is. But nevertheless, so here now you really get a picture of this guy sitting in an office.
Porco is looking for information for his series of plays on life and the Aleutians during World War II. He says the archives do more than just store history. They inspire creativity.
I'm trying to get as clear a picture of what it was like to live and be there at that time.
National Archives and Records Administration officials say they're closing the facility's doors because of low numbers of visitors, only 352 per year on average since 2009. More than half of the reference requests are written. Closing the facility and transferring about 75% of the holdings to Seattle will save NARA about $500,000 per year. At the request of the state's congressional delegation, the other 25% of the records will go to the state archives in Juneau. Among them are most of the territorial court records that are held at NARA. They include everything from civil and criminal court dockets to coroner's inquests. Kip Knutson with the governor's office says they looked into many options for keeping all of the records in Alaska, like moving all of them to the archives in Juneau.
I have a feeling that's probably outside of our budget desires, but we looked at all options. The federal employees were not really very enthusiastic about all of them, quite frankly, and they were even a little bit resistant to leaving the territorial court records.
Knutson says the governor's office even did a survey of all the state agencies to see how they would be impacted by the archives closing. He says it would be an inconvenience, but it's not devastating. But other organizations in the state, like the Alaska Federation of Natives, say moving the archives is more than just an inconvenience. The archives include everything from village census records from before statehood to histories of fur seal hunts in the Pribilof Islands. Nicole Borromeo is AFN's general counsel.
Well, it's going to create a huge void and vacuum in the Native community. I've personally been down to the archives doing research, and the information there is just phenomenal. It's a living history, and to have that removed from our community is going to leave an impact.
Borromeo says her organization is still working with Alaska's congressional delegation to try to get more records to stay. NARA plans to eventually make all of the records available online, but the agency does not have any money set aside to digitize Alaska's history. They're accepting recommendations for what should be digitized until the end of the month. Jo Antonsen is the state's historian. She says she prefers the records stay in Alaska, but digitization could work if Alaskans participate in the process.
It's so important for Alaskans to speak up, speak out about what records they need to have access to. And after the list is compiled, we need to keep vigilant to make sure that plans become action in getting things digitized and available.
NARA is considering having citizen archivists like Peter Porco help with the process. Back in the research room, he leans over the table with his digital camera and portable scanner, capturing what he can. But he says it doesn't work for everything.
This is a 1941-43 blueprint or something, and it filled the entire table plus. Now, that's no way you're going to digitize that.
He has until June 20th to try. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
The state says it will cost as much as $400 million to build a controversial proposed mining road to Ambler. But some opponents of the road think that figure is too low. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
On Friday, the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas met in Anchorage for one of its three meetings each year. The Ambler Road project was discussed due to plans which call for a portion of the road to pass through the gates of the Arctic National Park. Mark Davis, a deputy director with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, which is handling the project for the state, gave one of the overall cost predictions for the project.
I gave you the potential estimates of this road, which would be first brought in as a pioneer road and then maybe expanded, so between $190 million and $300 million.
Other ADA representatives are quick to clarify, though, that that is a very rough estimate. Mary Ellen Tuttle works for Dowell HKM, the company managing the road project, and says a more conservative range is $200 to $400 million, and that's just for construction. It doesn't include all the preliminary studies or permitting, which could cost the state as much as $60 million. But Ron Yarnell, a wilderness guide offering public testimony, says he believes those cost ranges are unrealistically low.
The idea that the road costs $100 to $300 million is totally fallacious. I mean, these estimates are even a single lane road. The bridges on this road are huge. I mean, the bridges alone on this job are going to be probably $100 to $200 million.
Yarnell also questions ADA's claim that the industrial road will be closed down and remediated once operations have stopped in the mining district the road would service. It was a point also picked up by Jill Yordy, a researcher with the Northern Center in Fairbanks.
It was mentioned that the road could possibly be reclaimed, and yet I've heard no mention about the cost of reclaiming the road and who would pay for those. Whose shoulders would that financial burden fall on? And if it is going to be ADA or the private entity that pays for and maintains the road, then those costs should be included in the road proposal and considered from the beginning.
In his response to the public's testimony, Davis explained the cost for road reclamation will be determined during the environmental impact study process. And after the meeting, Tuttle clarified that the eventual financing model will use tolls to collect repayment for the road's overall cost from its private users. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack and stroke, miscarriage and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Alaska is not alone in its conflicts with the federal government over land management. Leaders in some lower 48 western states want Alaska to join an effort to gain control of federal lands within their borders. Kathleen Clark directs the state of Utah's Public Land Policy Coordination Office.
All of the states need to dialogue with one another and to expand the conversation, so that we have a coalition of states that have a voice in Washington.
Clark, a former national director of the Bureau of Land Management, was in Fairbanks Friday at the invitation of Alaska's Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. Clark says Alaska has a lot in common with Utah and other western states.
What we perceive to be overreach of federal government and the challenge of getting some balance in that management that respects local citizens, tradition, culture, economics, and all of those things that contribute to a good quality of life.
Clark provided the State Commission with an update on an American Lands Council initiative supported by Utah and several other states aimed at getting some BLM property turned over to them.
If we work together and transfer title and ownership, it would free the federal government of a whole lot of burden and expense, as well as allowing the western states to, for example, to contribute to the issue of national energy security. So I think there's a lot of positives that could come.
Clark said the effort does not target national parks, refuges, or other wilderness areas. Clark and fellow land transfer advocate Montana State Senator Jennifer Fiedler cited economic studies that show states making money by managing BLM lands for resource development. Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas Chair, Alaska State Representative Wes Keller, says the commission regularly hears about federal overreach from Alaskans and emphasized the broader issue is not unique.
We had a tendency, I think, in Alaska to think we're the only one, but other western states are experiencing the same thing. So, I see it as just a sharing of information and getting together with other states.
Keller was clear that the state of Alaska isn't formally supporting land transfer at this point, and the commission is just gathering information. Wells Fargo is donating land to the village of Eklutna. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
That's a song written in honor and appreciation for a gift from Wells Fargo. It donated 143 acres of land next to the village of Eklutna, which is about 25 miles northwest of Anchorage, to the Conservation Fund for permanent preservation. The land is a sacred place to the local Dena'ina Athabascan people who scatter the ashes of loved ones there. It's also used for hunting, fishing, and berry picking. Eklutna Tribal Council President Lee Steffen says conserving the land increases villagers' well-being.
This is for your benefit. This is for your prosperity.
Although the Dena'ina have lived here for thousands of years, undisturbed remains from their earlier days are scarce in the Anchorage area, so it's also significant that remains of semi-subterranean homes and storage caches have been identified on the land. And the name of the village of Eklutna is based on Dena'ina Athabascan words that mean river that flows by two hills, referring to a unique granite formation on the land. Curtis McQueen, CEO of the Eklutna Village Corporation, says the gift also helps meet two goals of villagers.
We are very excited because as Anchorage has grown and the Mat-Su has grown,
We have tried to preserve as much cultural land as possible while also providing as much inventory to the cities to grow.
Wells Fargo announced the gift at the Native Village of Eklutna's powwow that's held every 2 years. Hundreds of people turned out for it this year, including many from the Lower 48 who are in Anchorage for the National Congress of American Indians mid-year conference that started Monday morning and continues through Wednesday at the Denina Center in Anchorage. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Tlingit wood carver Tommy Joseph was in Anchorage last week to repair a totem pole that will become part of the Anchorage Museum's collection. APRN intern Joaquin Palomino has more.
I'm not really scrubbing the paint too much. We're just cleaning the surface of it so we have a mild...
That's Tommy Joseph, a Tlingit wood carver from Sitka. He's in Anchorage refurbishing a totem pole he carved 15 years ago.
We're going to go back and I'm going to refresh the paint and put new paint on it.
The totem pole, originally commissioned by Alaska grocery store owners Larry and Wilma Carr, was recently donated to the Anchorage Museum. At a length of about 10 feet, the red, black, and green carving has a crow adorning the bottom half. There's a man with his arms crossed on the top half. It's one of a handful of totem poles on display at the Anchorage Museum, but Joseph's work is exhibited all over the world.
I've got them in California, Washington, Chicago, Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, London, Germany, New Zealand.
In a way, Joseph has become a cultural ambassador for the Tlingit, and he's excited to bring his carvings to Anchorage.
It's all about educating and sharing our culture with people from wherever they are. It's very cool. It gives me the opportunity to go to places that I probably wouldn't have gone before and telling their story, but the way we do in a totem pole.
Once the totem pole is restored, it will be displayed inside the museum. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, and Jacqueline Estes in Eklutna. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage, Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C., and Joaquin Palomino from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.